I'm just saying it's a delight to be here, first of all, and a number of people have been asking me who arranged for you to be invited to go and who thought up that title. Well, I've found out since I've been here, so thanks to the committee, and I'm very thankful for the title, though I have to say I spoke to a number of people and said this really, the title is What is Driving Identity Ethics? If anybody's looking for a PhD, this would form a good base for a PhD, except it's such a moving landscape, it would soon become out of date. But I hope we can serve one another as we think through these matters, because it's not a case of us being self-righteous and thinking we're thankful that we're not in that mess. Where would any of us be without the grace of God? And surely one of the things we can say is that there is nothing better than being a Christian. And having to do some of the research here, it really fills you with a deep compassion for the lens to which people will be driven. And so the title is, and I think it is important that ordained ministers speak into matters like this. We shouldn't just leave everything to so-called professionals. I remember once speaking on a particular topic that was way out of my expertise or whatever you may think of. And there was an expert actually on that topic. And the person said, well, you did pretty good for a layman. And it just didn't sit comfortably with me. But over the following few weeks, I thought, well, ordained ministers need to be prepared to speak on anything. And there's not this religious secular divide that we don't have things to speak into. But, well, what's driving identity ethics? We'll look at what identity ethics is in a moment. But the answer is really, what's driving it is the psalm we just read and sang. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works, and there is none that doeth good. Every vacuum has to be filled, and when the gospel is rejected, and God is rejected, and the truths of God are rejected, it doesn't mean that things won't happen. It means that that vacuum will be filled with something else. The question is, what will it be filled with? I think in New Testament terms, what's driving identity ethics is 1 John 2 verse 16, which is very helpful for all that is in the world. The lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not from the Father but is of the world. And this helps us to think through. And I think it's true to say that all of us, put myself first and foremost, we have too low a view of sin. And if we didn't have such a, a greater biblical understanding, we would perhaps be less shocked when we see newspaper headlines. Well, as I've said, this is a big topic for us, but people used to talk about situational ethics. Remember those days? Well, nowadays, identity ethics captures more the contemporary mood for us to determine what drives ethical decision-making in the world for individuals and also politicians. So it's crucial for us as ministers to address these matters so we can help people biblically and pastorally. We're living in a very tragic position in the United States and in Europe where very pridefully governments are very quick to cut the handbrake cable, take the brakes off the car and lead people to drive headlong into disaster in the name of liberalism. So this whole theme of identity has become a very rich theme to me during this year. And I've really been looking forward to coming, especially in the last 2 or 3 months. What is identity? Well, it's the fact of being who or what or a person or a thing is. We think of identity to serve to establish who is the holder of something. For example, someone's signature reveals something of their identity, or perhaps a photograph. But what's the question in terms of the West of what identity is? Sadly, identity ethics has become not only but especially directed towards sexual orientation. And the mind boggles when you think about this, but it's not just limited to sexual orientation. There's not only identity ethics, but there's also identity politics, and we may be aware of. There's a man called Mark Liller who's critiqued Hillary Clinton's. Hillary Clinton, as a Democrat, has developed something called identity politics. You may think, well, what on earth is identity politics? Well, identity politics is where Hillary Clinton has identified, in her view, different policies for different sections of society. So different policies for lesbians, for the disabled, for the Hispanics, and so forth. But Mark Liller has really critiqued this whole approach. But we won't go any further, except the whole theme of identity runs all over the place. Identity theft, identity crises, and so on. So identity ethics, what is it then? It's a subjective ethical judgment made by individuals based on freedom, and it's often reinforced by liberal policies of politicians who have a liberal value system about how an individual should live their life. But there are conflicts all over the place. There are conflicts that probably were not really there even at the beginning of the year. I've noticed on the newspaper outside, the headlines is about a Pride March, I think, in Glasgow. Now, do you remember a few years ago, people used to talk about global warming? We don't really hear that now, do we? Because they've changed their language to climate change. That's now the blank check for everything. A few years ago, people used to talk about the gay Pride March. Remember that? It's the word gay has been slashed out, and it's now the Pride March. And the recent Pride March in London, there were people protesting from the lesbian and gay community against other people of more, shall we say, complex sexual orientations. So it was getting longer and longer. The LGBT plus is now known as, and you can keep on adding that one. But there's now internal strife and confusion and disunity between the different. Well, the L and the G are not happy about the B and the T's, if you can get your brain around that one. And so there is real internal strife, and so it's now called the Pride March, which is kind of an umbrella for whatever your orientation is. This is for you. But the lesbian and gay, standing for male homosexual community, they are not happy about this. You know the rainbow that is their banner has six colours, but minus one in the rainbow, which is the violet colour. So it's not the complete rainbow. It's seven minus one. But there we go. Now, this subject seems like one of the most important ones to us, and it is certainly important. We need to be equipped with this contemporary state of affairs. You may have seen a couple of YouTube clips, which I'd certainly recommend to all of us to watch. One is, it's done in the United States, it's done by a family ministries organization, I think they are, that asks the question on university campuses, can a 5'9" white guy be a 6'5" Chinese woman? And it's they're not trying to be cynical, they're trying to tease out from people and say, you know, what do you think if I say this? Even to the point, how would you feel if I said to you, I'm a something like a 7-year-old child and wants to go out to kindergarten? What do you think about that? Well, if you want to identify as that, who am I to say not? And so I recommend that you listen to that one. Can a 5'9" white guy be a 6'5" Chinese woman? There's another one on YouTube by the same family organization, which I found just, I don't know if I'm getting old or not, I don't know, but it was just so disappointing. Interviewing college, obviously what they call it in the States for university, interviewing college young people and asking the question, do college kids know the difference between men and women? And the question is, well, whatever you want to identify as. If you want to identify as a female elephant almost, you can. But it's ridiculous. In the end, the interviewer, I think he says to the person, I'm a man, aren't I? And the person couldn't answer. And he said, you know I'm a man. But the logical steps is just confusion. Let me give you some real life illustrations though, because we need to pastor people. And it may not be immediately church members that may be faced with this, but maybe church members who are faced with this in the workplace. Here's an example of a Christian that spoke to me, can't mention the company, but this is about 8 years ago. This is before this kind of thing was more prevalent. The human resources called in the engineers of this company, which were almost all men, And they announced to these male engineers who were designing and so forth in this manufacturing company that Brian now wants to be identified as, let's say, Matilda. Well, you can imagine all the male engineers 8 years ago are looking at each other thinking, what is this? And that from now on, he, she will now be using the female toilet during their gender transition. And the team must now call him, her, that name and so on. I remember 8 years ago, this Christian asking my advice, what should I do? It's very difficult to know what to do because you've got to pretend as if there's nothing happening. It's very difficult. An American couple who were with us in our house just a few weeks ago, they went on a dream holiday to Southern Ireland, to the west coast, to the mountains over there. And somewhere on the west coast, I think the Southern Irish government the legislation is dripping down and they've decided to abandon male and female toilets. And she was really, the word offender is not the word, but she just felt this is a real transgression of her own rights. That it was just a very large toilet space where men and women and boys and girls were all to mingle in to go together. And she just felt, as a woman, this is just against nature. So we see that policies, and she said, well, don't I have a right to not be treated in such a way? So we see the confusion. If you see travel launch advertisements, they have a man and then this kind of, not male, not female, but kind of male puppet in bed together, inferring, you know, that no longer is life about families in hotels. It's just affecting marketing and all kinds of different things. I've got a number of friends who are involved in schools, school principals. It's not uncommon for a Tuesday morning for most likely, I'm not saying it would never be a family, but perhaps a mother with her partner that comes in again with... I'm trying to choose names that no one's got a name of, so, you know, that Norman now has decided, he's 13, and he's decided that he wants to be a girl called Bethany. And you've got to sit there with a straight face. And what they insist upon is that this child now takes on this new name and now switches changing rooms in the PE department. And it's as if you're not even allowed to even question, well, let's just take a pause button, let's just think this one through. So these are challenging pastoral situations that people are facing right now. What about some books on the subject? Well, I came across this one, The Ethics of Identity by Kwame Anthony Appiah. So if you go on Amazon and different outlets, you'll find there's quite a lot of books on identity ethics. Another one, Personal Identity and Applied Ethics, a historical and philosophical introduction by Andrea Saucelli. This one I found remarkably interesting, not written by a Christian. Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. Doesn't that encapsulate the mood of the day? In fact, Maguire writes in his introduction, indeed, we live in a world of sexual denial. We are increasingly trying to treat men and women as if they were exactly the same. And then we're surprised by the growing sexual confusion. So these are non-Christian writers beginning to speak out and seeing that common sense is not prevailing. So let's take a look at three headings of this paper. Firstly, identity, man-made in the image of God. Let's just seek a refuge of coming back to Holy Scripture to regain our sanity for a moment. Secondly, identity, fallen man's identity in the image of God, and to what degree is it blurred and marred, and of course it is. And then man's identity restored through the gospel. So let's take a look again at, firstly, identity, man-made in the image and the likeness of God. And I like what we looked at the other day from Colossians, that Christ is the image of God. But man is made in the image of God. But also in the paper this morning, we know that that the man and the woman are their image bearers. But the gulf, when we look at the attributes of God, that we looked at, that God is incomprehensible. God is eternal. God is infinite. God is invisible. And God made man visible in his own image and likeness. So theologians obviously have pondered this for centuries. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? Genesis chapter 1, 26, then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." Then he said, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. I was discussing with one of our ministers about this paper, and he said to me, "Kevin, you know, sometimes people say to me, what's your feminine side?" And he said to me, as a man, he said, "Listen, I tell them, I don't have a feminine side. I don't have a feminine side." That's not some macho Yorkshire phrase. It's a reality. I'm a man. And so there are only two options, male and female. We'll come back to that. And then 28, and God blessed them, and God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply." But I just want the phrase there, "And God said unto them." And God said unto them. We'll come back to that in a moment. I think what's important when we look in Hebrew at the words for image and likeness, you don't yield that much from looking at the words in the original text, which tells us that just word studies on their own is not sufficient to come to the truth of Scripture. We need the analogy of faith, and we need confessions of faith and so forth, where people have wrestled with things over the years. The triune God made man in our image after our likeness. And basically the words for image and likeness in Hebrew is image and likeness. But what does it mean for man to be made in the image of God? And this is important for all of us to be thinking through again. Well, the Westminster Confession, chapter 4.2 of creation, the confession says, after God had made all of the creatures, he created man, male and female, with reasonable and immortal souls, endued with knowledge, righteousness, and true holiness, after his own image, having the law of God written in their hearts, and power to fulfill it, and yet under a possibility of transgressing, being left to the liberty of their own will, which was subject unto change. Beside this law was written in their hearts, they received a command not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, while they kept, they were happy in their communion with God and had dominion over the creatures. The Westminster Shorter Catechism obviously is shorter. Question 10, how did God create man? God created man, male and female, after his own image. And these three words I like, knowledge, righteousness and holiness with dominion over the creatures. Because what's restored in the gospel? Knowledge, righteousness and holiness. But the larger catechism, question 17, how did God create man? After God had made all other creatures, he created man, male and female, formed the body of the man of the dust of the ground and the woman of the rib of the man, endued them with living, reasonable and immortal souls, and made them after his own image in knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, having the law of God written in their hearts and power to fulfill it, and dominion over the creatures, yet subject to the fall. So we, in a nutshell, there are five things that we can think of regarding man's original state of innocence. The endowment of a reasonable soul. A reasonable soul, made in knowledge, righteousness, holiness, with the law of God written on their hearts. Now, we're going to consider in a moment what was lost in the fall, but we want to just think for a moment, this is how God made the first man and the first woman. What a glorious, dignified picture it is. What an undignified nonsense. Evolutionists. What a tragedy. What a falsity. What a lie. But not only are those five vital points as to how God has made man his image, but secondly, we notice, and we must really impress this, that there are only two options biblically In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And we all need to be refreshed in our knowledge of the Bible, because much of the pressures around us want us to give way, that there could be other possibilities. There's no alternative to the Maker's model of male or female other than rebellion to the living God. And notice also, it's the living God who made man. And we sang a psalm, I think earlier today, that one thing I want to bring out, apart from the image and likeness that we're made into, that we're male and female, but thirdly, something very significant about man and woman is that God created man and woman with a pair of ears and the capacity to hear God's word and to respond to it. And biologically, our ears are probably two of the most significant parts of the human makeup. Because not only were they created male and female, but God then spoke to them. I mean, like right now, just think about this right now. I am, all your eyes can see is my lips kind of going like this. And what's happening in the room, miraculously, is that God has created me and you, created me to be able to make compressions of air into the room and giving you these marvelous ears on the side of your brain that can take the compressions of air that are running through this room and interpret those compressions of air into thought patterns and words in our minds. Isn't that majestic? Glorious. So man is created with the capacity, not so much just speaking, but hearing as a biological function from the Maker. Genesis 1 verse 28, and God Elohim said to them, God said to them. And of course, right now, we can no longer hear God's voice. If God spoke to us audibly, we couldn't take it. We can't see God anymore. Because if we saw him, it would be the glory would be too enormous. And God's not speaking audibly, but as we read the word of God, he's speaking. What a wonderful thing it is. So we have people down south of the border, they're determined to hear God's voice. And we say to them, do you want to hear God's voice? Yes. I said, just open the Bible, start reading it. Yeah, but that's not enough. I want the audible voice of God. I said, that's okay. Just read the Bible out loud. I think we have more of those characters south of the border than you have north. We have to. One thing about being in England, you have to answer so many questions every week. In fact, one of the questions came recently about why do we stand in public prayer? That's a good question, isn't it? Why do we stand in public prayer? So I said, well, let me give you some information. And emailed some different postures in prayer. And as a session, we were just thinking about it and thought, well, in society, what kinds of people do we stand up for in their presence? One is a judge, can all arise. Another one is a king or monarchy. And isn't it a wonderful thing that when we're standing in prayer, we're not doing that just because we've always done it. We're doing it because we're in the presence of the holy angels and the holy judge, to whom we shall all give account. And are you prepared, even today? There was a helpful phrase, wasn't it, hearing about that boxer who died and he's gone to meet his judge. Are you and I prepared and preparing to meet your judge? Well, may God help us by his grace. Okay, identity, fallen man's image distorted. That's what's driving identity ethics, because it is so distorted. And we've said every vacuum has to be filled. We know in the Decalogue, in the Ten Commandments, that the law has a threefold purpose. I think of it as the three R's to help people to remember that the law of God reveals. It reveals Christ. It reveals God. It also reveals our own sinfulness. The law of God is intended to be a rule for life. But thirdly, and of course it's very simplistic, but it's also intended to restrain sin. Now, I remember reading a number of years ago one very godly man who has now gone on to heaven saying that legislation will never, you can't legislate morality. And I have to say, I disagree with this. Legislation does shape morality. And we're living in a time now where our own government in this nation, not only the UK and Scotland and elsewhere, that legislation has been passed, that temptations have been placed before people that have not been placed before. And that governments do have, politicians do have, a moral responsibility to pass responsible legislation and legislation that protects people. And never mind only being shaped by the Bible, which we certainly pray for, but legislation that would protect people. And of course, we live in a day when people call good evil and evil good. And I remember lamenting going to see my own MP when they were railroading through same-sex adoption. You remember at school when sometimes you maybe at 6, 7, and they give you a graph with a few points on. Remember that? And the teacher said, you've got to draw a way that graph's going to end up. And you knew where it was going to end up. You just kept on following where it was going to go. And when same-sex adoption came in, it wasn't rocket science to know. You draw the lines on the graph where this is going to go. That was the thin end of the wedge, but politicians know we can't pass it all at once. But those politicians have much to answer for in their role as legislators. Now, what I'm going to tell you is extremely sobering, but one of the biggest tragedies of our own generation is the wide-scale slaughtering of the unborn. Where does that begin from? Identity ethics. When you degrade somebody made in the image of God, and we have a pregnancy advice center in Sheffield, so I'm not speaking off the cuff, but as a theologian, as a pastor, I don't use the word fetus, though there is a place to use that medically in certain ways. But we notice how the language changes rapidly. And that often now people will talk no longer even about abortion. That's often not used. It's called termination. And it's not even that now. One of the common things, one of the explosive growth industries is that of chemical murdering of babies by the mother, one who can easily access medications with the unfettered use of language such as, I have decided to pass my pregnancy. It's no longer a baby. It's a pregnancy. Now, we have to have compassion. We know stories of people, of one lady who was advised, should I keep the baby, should I not? Should I keep the baby, should I not? And then she was decided to take these medications, and you take some orally, and then some are inserted vaginally towards the end. And what it does, it then causes everything to give way. And the kind of outlook is that the identity of what's in the mother's womb is basically a blob of tissue. It's not. In fact, I should have brought a model. From 5 weeks and 5 days, the heartbeat begins. And this lady took the medication, and everything came out in the toilet. And there she saw her dead baby. And nobody had told her what she was passing. And how many people have got enormous regret that 1 in 5 women today now have had an abortion? That's a staggering statistic. But not only the murdering of babies because the identity of that baby is given something other than human status, but let's have compassion for the significant depression and suicidal tendencies that women are beginning to face and told, just get over it. You can't get over it. Men and women are made very differently. And for women, this is deeply part of a woman's makeup. And we're facing probably the biggest moral issue, I think, an even stronger moral issue than the anti-slavery movement. And we need to respond to this, and this is all connected to identity ethics, that the identity of the human being in the mother's womb is falsely dehumanized, something that is valueless, until the mother decides to confer life upon it. Even to the point that in many times in hospitals, that the mother will not be shown the ultrasound image until she makes a decision. if she makes the decision, notice the husband or the father can't make that decision, which has got other issues as well. But once the mother makes the decision to keep it, then she'll be shown the image of the unborn baby. But not until. It's remarkable, isn't it? Why? Because secular scientists know that when the woman sees the image of the unborn baby, she'll want to keep it. And I've been told this personally, that you shouldn't show a woman the image of the unborn baby because it could impact her decision. This is identity ethics in many different ways. My argument was, would you buy a car on that basis? Surely you want all the information to make a good decision. But no, they say that would be influencing the woman unduly. And we really need to be much in prayer regarding this matter. Now, when we think about the book of Genesis, Cain and Abel teaches us that sin didn't evolve over maybe 1,000 years. From the moment of the fall, sin was fully alive. And Cain murdering in cold blood. So we know that man's made in the image of God. The question then is how much of that image remains in fallen man? And we're not going to really fully resolve that, because we know that man lost original righteousness and holiness, and his communion with God was severed. He was driven out of the Garden of Eden. And that communion, we know, is only restored through Jesus Christ and through the blood of Jesus. But that communion was lost and original righteousness was lost. But what's left in terms of the image of God in us? Well, it is still there, because after Noah's flood, despite the fall, the Lord spoke and said that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and reiterated that covenant commission command. And then from his fellow men, the Lord said he would require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God has made man in his own image. So in Genesis chapter 9, God is repeating that man is still made in his own image. Therefore, the value of human life is huge. Now, in the fluidity of this gender issue at this moment in time, one of the primary issues needs scrutiny. In listening to these YouTube interviews, you realize what a subjective worldview people have. All the medical information tells us that the DNA of a man can never change no matter what you do to it. And same with a woman. Well, this gets suppressed. The physique of a man, the biology, the difference is in our mental approach. Whether someone is male and female, it's all there. The question is, though, in the world, is what do you want to identify as? What do you want to identify as? Just goes against any common sense. It's catastrophic, this fluid identity ethics with no justifiable boundaries. But I do want us to have compassion in the process. I was sent an article recently of a man who was one of several children. His father died and his mum entered into a same-sex relationship with another woman. He's not a Christian. But he went to college or university in the United States, and the LG community then targeted him, were waiting for him, and said, hey, welcome to university. You're obviously going to turn out a homosexual because your parents are homosexual. He found growing up with having two women bring him up, he says that he's even to this day, he cannot relate to either men or women. He doesn't know how to relate to either. He says that it's messed him up for life. And he's not being harsh, but he just couldn't work out what his own identity was. And so he ended up dropping out of college, university. It's a very sad story. Could be sadder for some, though. He ended up dropping out of university, ended up engaging in homosexual, male homosexual relationships. And we'd have to say, by God's providence, he didn't use that word in the article. But he ended up falling in love with a woman which he's now married to and has children. And now he recognizes that needs to be put behind him. And temptations, he's not a Christian, any temptations need to be completely gone. Effectually, in the article, he's saying any such thing as a same-sex attraction has to go. And here you're listening to a non-Christian and a social scientist who writes his article. The LGBT community are very angry at people like him and trying all their best to suppress everything they're saying, that being brought up by two women has been had a lifelong detrimental impact, and that I'm now in a married relationship. They're saying, well, look, that means you're technically bisexual. And so they've said to him, persecuting him, that being bisexual, you are polluting the lesbian and gay community. So he feels totally ostracized because of his background. He feels completely ostracized by this so-called community. And the social scientist who's beginning to compile data that's just now beginning to start and come out. More will come. When you sow the wind, you'll reap the whirlwind. And we have governments, and our own government, that are creating whirlwind situations. This man says, the social scientist, not the man who's married with children, the social scientist says that he has little estimation, really, for liberal politicians. He says, because liberal politics and politicians does not think of the best interests of citizens. He said he used to work in the homosexual area in Bronx, New York, where liberal policies say just do what you want, and seeing dead corpses of men practicing homosexuality, dead with AIDS. He says this is the impact of liberal politics. So it's not a case of us being fundamentalist and difficult. Where does this lead? The Westminster Confession says, chapter 6 of the fall of man, sin and the punishment thereof, 6:2, by this sin they fell from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became dead in sin and wholly defiled in all the faculties and parts of soul and body. This corruption of nature during this life does remain in those that are regenerated, although it be through Christ pardoned and mortified, yet both itself and all the motions thereof are truly and properly sin. Question 18, the shorter catechism, wherein consists the sinfulness of that estate into which man fell? The sinfulness of that estate into which man fell consists in the guilt of Adam's first sin, the lack of original righteousness, and the corruption of his whole nature, which is commonly called original sin, together with all actual transgressions which proceed from it. So we see that there's something of the image of God left in man, his conscience, his ability to comprehend, according to the word of God in Romans 1, that God himself does exist. So not man is without excuse, though he's sinful, he will face the judge. But what's driving identity ethics? That's the title of the paper. Well, it's a flawed, this contemporary idea of who you identify as is a flawed subjective paradigm for life and ethics. What's a paradigm? It's just important just for a moment to spend a few minutes on paradigms, because this will answer a lot of things for us theologically and otherwise. Why is there clashes in the church sometimes? It's actually a clash of paradigms. And it's a bit like icebergs. You know, an iceberg, you know, 8% or so is underneath the water. But once you see 20%, you at least know there's an iceberg there. And Thomas Kuhn, in his groundbreaking work, he identified about the whole issue of paradigms, and the best definition of paradigm I've come across is this. A paradigm is a set of beliefs that guide our actions. So this room is full of paradigms. Why do you do what you do? Because your beliefs direct you to your actions. And so we need to understand paradigms. And it's an important thought, because there are, sociologically, you have either objective paradigms or a subjective one. and there's a middle ground in between critical theories. Marxism is a critical theory. I have to say confessional Presbyterianism is a critical theory that straddles between the two, where we believe that our theology has hands and feet and requires change. It's not just a theory. But if we think the metaphor that's used to describe an objective paradigm, and an objective paradigm might be people brought up in Britain in the 1930s, maybe, or 20s. There will be just some basic values that, you know, family is made of a man and a woman and so forth. It will be objective. So, but what is an objective paradigm? Well, the metaphor they use, interestingly, is that of a house. That of a house, something solid and stable. What's the metaphor that's used, interestingly, for a subjective paradigm? It's actually something called Neurath's boat. And it's a model and a metaphor that's without a foundation. And it believes that it's made up, this boat, of a raft of individual planks, beliefs, that support one another, and each plank can be replaced without affecting the whole, like a raft. No rudder, no anchor, just free floating. And what a difference between a metaphor of a house and a raft made up of planks. So who knows what plank will be, you know, the plank might be transgender today. That could be replaced with something else next week. I don't know what it'll be replaced with. But a subjective paradigm in the world and in the church is a disaster. It's a disaster. So people talk about now, I believe, or I feel, or if that's what you think. There's even the idea of a snowflake and the word safe space. Have you come across safe space? Certain universities in the US now create rooms in the university and they call it safe space. And in that safe space, nobody will confront you of your views on anything. Because people now bought into this kind of worldview, they can't handle anybody questioning anything about themselves. It's tragic, isn't it? No wonder the world in their flesh are not going to rejoice about propositional preaching. But we preach in season and out of season. So, thirdly, man's identity restored through the gospel. Again, this is brief. I mean, I feel that was like an introduction, lecture one. But you're getting the idea that identity ethics in the world is very, very subjective. And the damage it produces in people is huge. Like this man said, brought up with two women, he'll have to live with the impact, he says, of that for the rest of his life. While man's identity restored through the gospel, though man is fallen, still maintains something in the image of God, but it's only through Christ and the cross that there really is forgiveness and cleansing. Ephesians chapter 4, 22, we're to put off our old self. Put it off. And then it talks about the deceitful desires and that we're renewed in true righteousness and holiness. What was lost in the fall is restored through the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I don't know how this may work, but what I do know is that Jesus said, unless a man is born again, he can't enter the kingdom of heaven. But let's not, it seems so confused, this kind of massive spaghetti. But let's remember, we're not leaning upon ourselves, we're leaning upon the glorious Saviour who can restore things, and we don't know how really fully, and to think through all the implications. As somebody I read about just a few days ago, of a man who had a gender transition to become a woman, and when he became a woman, he realized, I'm not happy, so he transitioned back. But he's realized now, back as a man, this is not working either, and is now on his third transition. Don't ask me, medically, who's paying for NHS? I don't know all the answers to those questions. What would happen then if that man, who's now, becomes born again? What we do know is that the power of the gospel can transform us. I don't know how. I mean, my mind can't really do a paper on how to pastor people in those positions. But we may have to face those soon. And wouldn't it be a glorious thing to face it? Pastoring really should be weak men on their knees, constantly unable to pastor people because we just don't have the answers. But it's very complex. There's, as we'll close with five. Sorry, it's not seven. Someone had a perfect number last night. I've got five. Pastoral matters for us to consider. Firstly, his identity confusion has entered into the church, has it not? 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 15 is very clear. God doesn't permit women to usurp authority and to teach. But this has entered into the church, a kind of an identity confusion. So I've even sat through a paper in an evangelical church in the last 3 years where the man taught that 1 Timothy 2, verse 15, his conclusion was that women are not permitted to teach or to usurp authority over men. His conclusion was women can teach and have authority over men. I wasn't trying to be clever at all. I thought, just see how this works out. And a lot of people were nodding heads, and this was wonderful. So I put my hand up and said, can you just walk me through again how he got from Paul saying a woman cannot to you saying a woman can? And what he was saying, and this is out there now big style, is that, let's say in a Church of England church, and especially a larger church, a woman can do everything now except wear the ministerial collar and preach the sermon. And so many churches, Anglican churches now, a friend of mine went to a large Anglican church recently, and he said there was only two men who did anything. I said, who was that? He said, the minister and the drummer. Women read the scriptures, they started the service, they led the singing. This is confusion. It's an identity crisis. We're made in the image of God, we're made equal male and female, but we have different roles in life and in the church. And if I raise things like this, like I think the thin end of the wedge, I think, in many churches was allowing women to read the scriptures. I think that was probably the thin end of the wedge before my time. But the result becomes very blurred in many ways. And a lack of identity leads to insecurity. It's a German word for chaos anyway. English word will do. It's chaos. Secondly, I think the whole idea of identity, that we're made in the image of God, I think provides a wonderful platform for us to think through for Christian education. Not just on a homeschooling level, though that would help, but for principals of schools and so forth, to think through a paradigm, a model to base education on, because sometimes Christian education can be a bit fundamentalist, a bit Bible-thumping, don't do this. But to actually base it on a framework of identity of man made in the image of God, male and female, then the fall, and then the restoration of the gospel, gives the ability in a non-confrontational way, in a biblical view, to explore all lines of discovery in different subjects, but also morally as well. To explain the equality, the dignified position, that actually, I think, can elevate our theology and practice in Christian education that could confound politicians. Who can argue against such a paradigm? That's not a fundamentalist Bible-thumping approach. It's a robust paradigm based on truth. And perhaps that would help to equip people involved in positions like that and needs further thinking through to recover the whole idea of identity. I've got to just come into a close, but in terms of pastoral matters to consider, I've got to raise this flawed issue of same-sex attraction movement, which has gained enormous traction within the professing evangelical church. There was a man called Ed Shaw who published a book by IVP in 2015 called The Plausibility Problem, The Church and Same-Sex Attraction. The problem with the book is that it gives way to say about same-sex attraction, but refuses to really call it sin. Yes. And it's interesting, this non-Christian man, who was brought up by two women, he actually crushes the idea. He says, as a man who used to practice homosexuality, he was extremely confused. He said, I cannot yield anymore to such past attraction. Well, he didn't use the word attractions. So I've got a non-Christian giving a more clear articulation that many British Christians who themselves have got an identity crisis and want to be nice, and even to the point of encouraging people to almost come out. I did a review of this book. It was at a foreword by Vaughan Roberts and 14 other glowing commendations. This book, The Breadth of Christian Leaders, celebrate that publication. Includes Dan Strange of Oak Hill, Terry Virgo, founder of New Frontiers, four female church leaders, and the Bishop of Winchester. And it's almost as if I'm crushed. You don't disagree with these people? And but it's a significantly flawed model. And it's got a tenuous foundation based on broad-based solutions. It doesn't deal with man's image and identity from Genesis, and doesn't really deal with the fall, and offers at best to be celibate. Well, upper middle class men may be able to hold out being celibate, but if you go to areas where I were brought up, that book would cut no ice. Live as a celibate. No, it's sin, and sin must be put to death. We must come to Christ. We're made male and female. Fourthly, pastoring people in the church. What would you do if a person comes last Lord's Day or next Lord's Day? How are you going to think through? They're cross-dressing. You may not even realize it's a man dressed in woman's clothes. You might not realize it. Are you going to be a naive minister that you're going to be, when they find out, you're going to be just totally flawed? We need to be prepared for these kinds of things. How are we going to practically seek to have people restored? I mean, I have to be very careful, as you probably do. I've had people contact me saying, look, I'm a male, but they don't use male homosexual. I'm a man living with a man, and we want to come to church. Can we become members? How do you answer that question? Well, our answer is, we'd love to see you at church. Come along. Because people need the gospel. And they don't come. But they're trying to catch us and trap us and so forth. But there's so much identity confusion out there that's driving people in all kinds of directions that we need to think through and maybe discuss as sessions, brainstorm, what kind of possibilities might there be? And this could even happen in Ness or more rural places. Who knows? How are we going to practically seek to restore people? And I want to say, in terms of pastoring people, I don't think hammering certain kinds of people from the pulpit is necessarily the best answer. I think a lot of preachers sometimes can be lack wisdom, that they go for the easy targets. So, you know, I'm going to prove I'm orthodox this Sabbath. I'm going to start preaching against transgenderism. I've heard this paper. And I'm going to hammer it. There's no transgender person there, but they're going to know that I'm orthodox. But is that really the best answer? You know, perhaps there's sins like religious hypocrisy that need hunting down. Of course, we need wisdom. But I just think, as preachers, we don't want to just hit the soft target contemporary sin that next year will be something else. If we're going to teach, we need to explain things clearly. People's minds are not going to be as clear, perhaps, as some of us are here. They're going to need winning to a more biblical position where they may have given in to compromises in the workplace and so forth. How would you pastor someone who's had a sex change, then becomes converted and recognizes they're now trapped in a body they can't change back? Well, we believe Christ is the fount of all wisdom, don't we? And we're going to need his wisdom. And maybe our sons are going to need more wisdom than we do. Because we're not really fully reaping yet what's been sown. We could list a number of questions on and on. I think fifthly, in terms of pastoral wisdom, we do need to stand against ungodly legislation. And not remain silent the whole time on such things. We must preach the whole counsel of God. We shouldn't wholly be magnifying just the latest legislation change. It just comes so fast. But we should be a voice in the pulpit as well, to give a clear note that we're salt and light. And as we close, and I feel as if I've done my best, that's all I can say, is that I think I wonder if Daniel can help us, as he served the Lord faithfully in successive governments in Babylon and Persia, and yet maintained a faithful, wise witness. So it is possible to walk with wisdom. And let's not have a bunker mentality. Oh, it's so dark. It became dark the second after Adam ate the fruit. And this world is in darkness. But we have the Prince of Life, who's been risen from the dead, who defeated sin and death and the devil and the world. Imagine having him on our side, which we have. So let's look to the Lord, but I wonder if Daniel could help us in these difficult days. Well, I'll stop there, and let's have as many questions as might be helpful. Over to you.